This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. My favorite episodes of Unregistered are ones in which the guest is unafraid not only to express heterodox, unregistered political views, but also the ways in which their personal lives intersect with and inform their politics. That is, it's an episode maybe like this one. But you be the judge. This is my interview with Bridget Phetasy. I am here with Bridget Phetasy, someone I've been following on Twitter avidly for, God, I don't know, how long have you been on Twitter? Since 2013, is that right?
Yep, that's when I really started engaging.
Yeah, and I don't know, I've probably picked up on you shortly after that. I've been reading you for a long, long time. Oh, I wanted to tell you something before we get into this. I wanted to thank you for a tweet, which you sent out, I don't know, probably four or five, maybe more than that, maybe 2 months ago during the quarantine. Low point for me at that moment. And I turned on Twitter and there you were. And this is the simplest thing. It just said, just keep going. And I swear to God, here I am, Mr. PhD, right? Mr. Fancy Podcast. I've been in psychotherapy for 10 years, right? But it's actually those little things like that, that are basically sort of like a kind of a version of mindfulness, I suppose, or something. It's just so simple for me, like little like boundaries or things that I can bounce off of when my depression and anxiety take off. So thank you for that. It really
did.
You're
welcome. And like,
for many, many days after that, I just kept thinking, oh, Bridget, she said, just keep going. So I did.
That phrase saved me so many times when I was getting sober, and even just writing and following kind of a path that doesn't have a path, the creative path, I guess. There were so many dark nights of the soul, and I would have people who had gone before me on their own path, and they always used to say, just keep going. And that just stuck in my head.
Did you get that from what we call the rooms in AA?
That actually came before. Well, actually, now that I think about it, it was a guy who, he is in the rooms, yes, but it was, he's also a writer. So it was more when I was still actively, wildly drinking. And when the first time I ever heard it, he was referring to just my career and just keep going. But he also had the pleasure of seeing me at my rock bottom.
For the normies out there, the rooms, when you've been through a 12-step program like AA, the rooms are just where the meetings are held. So that's what
now, now they're the Zooms.
of course. I've been out of AA for a while, but right, of course, there must be Zooming now. I hadn't even done
it's
that.
Great. I love it. Oh my gosh. A lot of people don't like it. I actually feel like I'm more engaged than I was. And I think because I can go to meetings in New York and I'm just more, I identify more with the East Coast vibe, I think, than the West Coast vibe, just being from the East Coast myself. And it's a lot of people who are in my kind of field. And it just, I don't know, I found this one. I've been going to meetings in London and Italy and just seeing people. That to me is amazing. I love that I can hear my sponsor speak, my old sponsor speak in Italy in a meeting.
I remember in one meeting, one of my favorite lines was a guy just stood up. This was in LA too. He said, you know what's great about us? We're like cockroaches. We're everywhere.
It's so true.
You can find a meeting. You can find a meeting everywhere, anywhere, at any time.
And we don't die.
Never die.
Despite our best efforts.
there's probably a meeting in Tierra del Fuego going on right now that we, I mean, anywhere in the world.
So maybe you've covered this before, but why aren't you in the Zooms anymore?
Oh, so I've been sober for almost 8 years, and you've been five now?
Seven in October.
Oh, we're close.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. September 2012 for me.
Yep. I was October 2013.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. So why am I? So it's because, well, a couple of reasons. One is that I'm slightly cheating, I guess, according to AA rules. I don't think it's cheating, but I'm on the green program.
Oh, the marijuana maintenance program.
Yeah. Although I wasn't for like the first 5 years, I was totally straight edge for five years. But for the last like three, I've been on the green program. So I'm not like sober, but, the other reason is that
I wish I could do that.
It wasn't hard for me. I hate to say this, but like, it was only about 3 months of like really struggling with it. And then it just like clicked, and like 5 o'clock would come and go, and I wouldn't even notice it. Whereas before, my entire day was organized around 5 o'clock
and drinking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Happy hour. And yeah, like, everything I did during the day, all the work I did was sort of like toward that moment when I could finally have my bourbon at 5 o'clock.
Okay. Right? Yeah. So. That's interesting. I mean, I think I don't judge anyone for what works. I wish I could do the green program. I actually tried it before I got sober. I did like a year of no drinking and just only smoking weed. And truly, weed is my first love of my life.
Oh, yeah.
But I will be waking and baking. You know, I'm not a person who will be like, I'm just going to smoke in the evenings. And like a lady, I will be waking up and getting now, I guess, whatever you use, whatever method. And I don't think it would be long before I was drinking, just because for me, there's such a short little, like, it's a very short bridge between being high on weed and being slightly buzzed. And I know that I'd be like down at the beach and I'd be kind of buzzed. And then I would be walking by on the waterfront and suddenly that hef would look really good. And I would be like, why not? And then I'd be doing lines at the townhouse.
Yeah.
You know, I know. I wish I had that. And maybe someday. And the weird thing is, when I quit everything, I was like, this doesn't mean I'm going to quit smoking weed. That's ridiculous. But I knew I had to quit smoking weed in order to quit drinking. So, and then once I went a couple of years, and there were moments where I was really depressed my second year of sobriety, to the point that my therapist and I got to that, like, walked right up to the edge of like, should we try meds? And I was like, if I'm going to use meds, I'm going to smoke weed. I was like, I would rather just smoke weed than go on some antidepressants. Not that I have anything wrong with them, but weed seemed to work well for me as an antidepressant.
Huh.
And perhaps that's what I was using it as all of those years that I was using it. Mm-hmm. And then I just kept pushing through, and then something kind of clicked. And I really think I started smoking weed when I was 13 or 14. And I think my brain just had to rewire. I'm not like a neuroscientist or anything, but I don't think my brain had any capacity for producing like good feelings of contentment and peace, or even knew what that looked like. And so then suddenly something hit around 2 years. And, you know, I was listening to music just right before we were about to podcast, and I was like, damn, this song would sound really good if I was stoned. It sounds amazing, by the way, not stoned. But I know it would sound just more amazing.
I will go listen to it right after this interview.
It's The Heavy. It's an old album from 2009. And it's, what's the name of the song? Somebody's Hero or something. It's so good, but it has this kind of there's just something about that song where I'm like, damn, this would be really good if I was high.
It's a good stoner song.
I miss it.
Yeah.
I miss it. That's good though. I think for some people, you know, that would be an advisable alternative if drinking is your thing and can just manage it.
It's so much less harmful. I mean, alcohol is clearly harmful, and it's the most harmful drug, I think. You know, I think that's pretty clear. And weed is probably the least harmful drug and has so little. I mean, the worst thing that'll happen is you might get paranoid or lazy. You know, I mean, that's
I was neither one of those things, really. I got some anxiety if I smoked weed that was too racy. But what I did notice, and what I've noticed, is that now in like dead straight sobriety is that weed was like a, it was like a glass ceiling that I didn't know existed. I could push myself to limits, and I was definitely not a lazy stoner. I was really motivated, but I didn't realize how much it hindered my ability. It still kept me kind of dumb in a weird way. And that was just my experience of it. And my brain started, once again, it came back online. It started firing on levels that I didn't really know that it was capable of even firing on. And so I'm not sure how much I, you know, I thought I was like being super creative and like a genius, but I was really actually limiting myself. And I didn't want to have any doubt once I entered into the Thunderdome about anything that I tweeted or anything that I wrote ever. I didn't want to be like, I just really high when I sent that tweet?
Right.
You know, I wanted to be able to stand firmly in whatever I did and not wonder, like, would I have tweeted that if I wasn't retardedly stoned?
Yeah. I just tweet when I'm retarded. Do I have some good news for all of us. Paloma Verde CBD has re-upped as the sponsor of the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm incredibly proud. Paloma Verde CBD, for those of you who have been watching recently, is a family-owned, independent, entrepreneurial business run by Vanessa and Carlos Abelar out of San Antonio, Texas. And they've had trouble from banks in terms of getting loans and even accounts. And they have had trouble getting the message out in the west side of San Antonio, which Carlos Abelar calls the brown side of San Antonio. And they wanted Unregistered to be a vehicle for their product, which they know helped them and their families. Their fathers, both of their fathers, suffered from chronic pain until they tried CBD. And that was actually the inspiration for founding Paloma Verde. So on a lighter note, they've got a whole bunch of new deals for us. They have 25% off, first of all. For all Unregistered listeners, you just use the discount code RENEGADE at checkout. You get 25% off any product. On top of that, if you're a first-time user or if you haven't joined their mailing list, join it. Go to their website, join their mailing list, and get an additional 10% off. So that would be 35% total on that first order. Then they've also put together what they call the Unregistered Combo Pack, or informally, the Thad Pack. These are my three favorite products, which I use literally every day. In fact, I just used the tincture just about 5 minutes ago. But this includes their gummies, which come in several flavors and are delicious. I totally vouch for them. I also vouch for their soft gels. I take these every day. Great for me, for anxiety and for insomnia. For other people, there are many symptoms that are treated by this. And then, as I just mentioned, their tincture, which is probably my favorite thing because it's fast acting. You put it under your tongue, and within just a minute or two, you can already feel the effects. So go to PalomaVerdeStore.com. That's PalomaVerdeStore.com. Put in the discount code RENEGADE. Join their mailing list. Check out the Thad Pack. You'll get deep, deep discounts on all that. And I think you'll change your life. Thank you. I have a question for you, which will have, I think, multiple meanings for you. How long have you been Bridget Phetasy?
That's a really great question.
People won't know what that, you know, there's an obvious meaning that you know, but that a lot of the audience won't know. That's not your birth name.
Yeah.
Just to clue people in real quick here, what's going on?
Yeah, that's a really great question, actually. No one's ever asked me that. It's so funny because even now when, for instance, I'm doing stand up and people will say, coming to the stage next, Bridget Phetasy, and I'll be like, like looking around and I'm like, oh, that's me. All right.
Is she funny at all? I mean, should I stay?
Like, I feel like this bitch is really annoying.
10 fucking bucks for the UCB for this bitch? Did you see what's going on at the UCB now? Oh my God.
Are they getting canceled?
And Groundlings, both totally canceled.
Oh.
They're getting, it's like a full on assault by the LA Times. A full on assault.
Oh, really?
Oh, they're taking them down. The LA Times.
For what?
For being racist forever, for being the Klan. I don't know. Like, it's the same stuff. It's the same for not having black people, for whatever this alleged thing or not.
Okay. But
let's not stay too long on this, but anyway, I just wanted to push that. But it's a huge deal in the LA comedy scene that this is going on. These are institutions, and I've played the UCB with Moshe Kasher, by the way. So, but like, it's horrendously psychotic, and it's like, what are we doing here? We're burning down like the best parts of sort of the anti-civilization of the United States, right?
Yeah.
Which is stand-up comedy.
What's so funny is that people think that the establishment is, like they don't realize they're the establishment now. You know, they think they're the progressive ones, and I'm like, you guys are basically the establishment.
Boss. Yeah, they're the boss. Yeah, I mean, they're literally, well, they're HR now. But anyway, back to you and your name, and what is it? How did you? It has an interesting origin too, right? The name itself.
Yeah, I guess, God, it goes back to like 2001 or 2002. It goes back to an idea for greeting cards. And then this phenomenon that was always happening to me that I didn't feel like there was an appropriate word for. So I guess the closest thing I could define it as at the time was a Seinfeldian moment, or a very convoluted definition that nobody understood. I just described it as irony squared, which is when irony doubles back on itself and becomes literal, or when reality becomes parody, which no one really understood, although everyone understands that now.
Yeah.
So that word, I just made up a word for it. I was like, it's a fetishy. It's a fetishy. I'm like, I just need something to describe these weird things that keep happening. And then I used it to as my company, because I wanted to make greeting cards, which I still do. I'm bringing them back. And they're called... the tagline is cards that say what the other cards are thinking. And they were for like dysfunctional families and those messed up situations that you don't have greeting cards for, because I came from a very dysfunctional family. And whenever we would go to my sister and I would go to the greeting card store, and we'd be like, is there a card for like happy Mother's Day? We kind of forgive you for marrying such a douchebag, but you know, like, there just isn't cards to describe those. Like, sorry, we haven't spoken 6 years.
It's okay, Mom, that you left the family. Happy birthday.
Yeah, my sister had a baby very young. You know, she had a child when she was 18. I'm like, where do you get a greeting card for this? Like, congratulations on graduating high school and also the baby. There just wasn't. And I'm still making these. I still have the whole line. I went bankrupt young. And my 20s were a shit show. And
I didn't know about the bankruptcy. I knew about all the other stuff we haven't even talked about. Oh my gosh. Okay. Good job.
So, oh yeah.
You did a lot. You were very productive in those years.
No, when I first moved back, so I was in LA right after rehab. I went to rehab when I was 19, and then I got in a car and moved to LA because that seemed like a great idea right out of rehab. Not a great idea. I lived in the Valley in a place in which there was lots of people who were characters that you would expect to live in the Valley in the 99-2000 area of my life, and did a lot of blow with B porn stars or C, playing dominoes all night long for days at a time. But I was like, well, I'm not using heroin, so I'm still sober. That was like how I justified
I'm one rung up the ladder.
Yeah. And then I went back east and tried to kind of, there was a lot of damage from family stuff, and I went back. My younger sister, there was a lot of reasons I went home and back east to the East Coast. And also, this person who was living in my building was a schizophrenic and thought that I was working for Oliver Stone and kept threatening to kill me. So I was like, maybe I should get the fuck out of here. And so I went back east, and what was supposed to be for like 3 months, I put my stuff in storage here in LA. And then my dad was like, don't get sucked into the restaurant rut, Bridget, because I'm from a resort town on the East Coast. And I grew up waitressing, and it's an easy rut to get sucked into when you're an alcoholic and a cokehead. And I absolutely did that. And then I got married to a Belarusian in a blackout. Ooh. And
Wait, hold on. What was that again? What
do you mean? Like a year-long blackout.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was married.
That's when the Belarusians swoop in. right? Isn't that, that's the
he
moment.
He and I are still such good friends. I love him so much. We're still such good buddies. I just, like, we were so young. I remember I was 23 years old when I look, and I felt really old because life had been a lot up to that point.
Definitely.
And so that's the weird, you know, and even now when I work with young women in their 20s and they're like, I'm so old, it's too late for me. I'm like, I really understand that feeling and I want to shake you and tell you, you are a baby. You're just a little child. You have so much life. You can still make up for all the time you feel you lost.
It's save your breath.
Never too late. Yeah.
Save your breath. It'll never work. They'll never, young people will never understand. I think it's impossible. They don't understand the future. Nor should they. I don't want them to, but they can't.
I don't know what I was thinking. So yeah, we got, and then I was real deep in alcoholism.
Cool.
And yeah,
me too.
Really deep.
We could swap some bottom stories if you want.
And, oh my
and God. for the gays out there, we're not talking about that. we are, you want to hear mine?
Yeah.
Well, I mean many, but like.
This was like, by the way, a full decade before I got sober.
I was a drunk for about 20 years, but
yeah, me too.
So for me, I moved to LA as an addict also in 2009. Totally. It was awesome. I mean, the thing is I was an alcoholic, so they have alcohol everywhere. It didn't help me too much. I wasn't into coke.
Where are you from?
I am from the Bay Area, Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What town are you from on the East Coast?
I don't always really like
you
to say.
Don't want
to
say.
Mean, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. It's just even the fact that it's not my real name, I'm like, let's try and keep my family out of this as much as possible.
They didn't ask
for me to become Bridget Fetissy, you know? So I do my best to like tell my own stories and not involve them.
I mean, that town would be like smoking rubble, right? The next day as I was going on, like they would just surround it with pitchforks and torches.
Yeah, let's not.
The witch Nazi was born here.
I was born in New York City.
Oh. I don't want them to burn that down. Not yet, anyway.
They already are.
They're trying. Well, the mayor's trying, as far as I can tell. He's trying to burn it.
Seems like everybody is trying. Yeah.
Well, he's trying to, I mean, the governor and the mayor have basically been trying to kill everybody there. So that's been pretty, you know, mostly effective. all right, wait. So the thing about your name is, though, isn't it?
Wait, no, go back to your rock bottom.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Move to LA.
Got it. See, denial. I'm still in it, right? I didn't want to talk about it. Well, let's see. There's one rock bottom. Is just a simple one. It was like several days a week. I was a professor at Occidental College. All right.
Mm-hmm.
There I was in my tweed jacket and everything. No, I didn't wear that. But I was definitely a professor, and I was at the end of my class, which was like at 4:30 or 5. Oh, that's a bad thing. I would go straight to like this ghetto ass liquor store and buy the cheapest vodka possible, and then I'd get also like a large cup with Sprite in it. And I would pour out half the Sprite and fill it with the vodka. So I'd have like probably a pint of vodka in this huge cup with a little bit of Sprite. And I would drive from Pasadena, basically Pasadena, which is all the way on the east side of LA, all the way to Mar Vista, which is in West LA, on the freeway, which was rush hour. So that took about an hour and a half. I am drinking vodka while driving for an hour and a half, several days a week.
Wow. Did you ever get pulled over?
I never got a DUI. I'm the lucky. I never hit anybody. I never hurt anybody. I'm so lucky in so many ways.
I'm so lucky in that. I came out of a blackout on the 405
well,
driving.
Not a good one. Nice. Yeah. I know a guy from the rooms who was driving this is not funny. He was driving the wrong way on the 10.
Yeah, it's not funny at all because I could have killed someone. And I remember coming out of that blackout praying to actually be pulled over. I was like, I am too terrified to drive. I'm so hammered. And I did the whole, like, if you close one eye, someone taught me this trick early drinking and driving in LA. If you close one eye and you line your steering wheel up with the oil line in the middle of the lane, like if you just keep your steering wheel lined up with a line from the exhaust,
oh my God,
you'll always be in the middle of the lane. And it worked.
Drunk driving advice. How to drive drunk from Bridget Fetissy. Thank you. This is great. Thanks, YouTube, everybody. It's been nice knowing you. You thought I was going to get canceled over like politics?
Hell yeah, no. It's going to be like Bridget Pettiser teaches the world.
We're advocating, we're teaching people how to be good alcoholics. In fact,
hey, I'm not saying it's smart, but I that was some weird trick that stuck with me. And then I remember that when I came out of that blackout, I was like, just get home. My roommate was furious with me, just like, you drove like that, are you fucking crazy? And I still drank for another 6 years or like four or 5 years after that.
Oh yeah, me too. The other one, and this is totally not funny at all, and I don't know if it's true, it's possible my girlfriend at the time made it up because she had a beef with everything, but apparently I passed out in front of my son. So and I don't know because I just don't remember it. And he never said anything about it, but it's definitely possible. I was certainly capable of it at that time. I didn't do a lot of passing out, but I was certainly capable of it.
Oh, I have a good one. I pulled down my pants and peed at the end of the couch in front of my sister and her boyfriend who were watching a movie on the couch.
That's what my girlfriend did that night.
And they were like, Bridget, what are you doing? And I guess I was like, popped a squat. And then I was like, like laughing, like I like this look of just devilish, like I knew what I was doing, but I was blacked out.
This must
be. And then I was trying to clean it up, and I was like sliding over the place and pee and paper towels. My sister's like, "Oh my god,
Bridget, I'm not kidding. Get out of here. I wasn't kidding. This must be a young woman thing. That's exactly what my girlfriend at the time did. She got really drunk and peed on the floor right in front of me. Is this a thing that like 20-something girls do in Los Angeles?
Oh, no. I've had multiple men pee on different things in my house. This is like wolf laws. And
yeah, but we're dignified. At least we're standing up while we're doing it. We're not squatting down in someone's...
I had an ex-boyfriend and he peed on my first Mac. Like, I remember I heard him get up in the middle of the night and I was like, where is he?
Your Mac?
And then I had my brand new computer. I'd never had a Mac computer.
Wait,
in
he
my
like
life.
Stood up and peed on your computer? Like, what is that?
Yeah, how passive aggressive is that?
Trying to ruin your career as a public intellectual.
This was at the dawn of Fetacy, actually. I was creating the brand then, or trying to. And I was about to go on a road trip and he wasn't happy that I was not taking him. And then he peed on my computer in a blackout. Honestly, I think it was like his 22nd birthday too. I don't know what.
I'm sorry, but I kind of like it. I mean, it's just funny. I mean, because it's so long ago. I mean, if someone peed on my computer now, I would kill them and then kill myself. But I'm just saying.
Even recently, a dude, not recently, but within the past maybe 5 years, some guy came over and he was blacked out and he peed on my roommate's Italian chair.
You know what?
Blackout.
I think we should introduce this to cancel culture, right? instead of like telling people that they should get fired, we should just go pee on everybody's computers. Right. Jordan Peterson, why are you so patriarchal? And just whip it out and just like ruin his stuff, man. Like on the plane, you know, you could just do it right there.
Yeah, you guys, tweeting is nothing. But yeah, I've had a lot of that.
Urine does the job. I'm just saying. I mean, with electronics, it would definitely screw up your career a little bit.
It magically didn't break my whole computer. It was not fun though to clean up.
I know. Yeah. Men, you know, men are disgusting. That's the thing. That's what you should
know. They are pretty gross.
I mean, basically, like, I don't know if you know this, but men suck. And I think they deserve like way more criticism and should be taken to task for, you know, centuries of suffering by women. No, anyway, back to you. is it true, am I right, that fetishy is an amalgam of fetish and fantasy?
I mean, people say that, and perhaps that's part of, I just played with words and landed on one that I liked the way that it looked. And I used the PH just because I liked the P and the Y, and it was kind of visually cool for me. And yeah, there was something about it. There is something about the space where different, I don't know. I love the overlapping of like, you know, fantasy has kind of these nicer connotations and fetish gets a little bit darker. And I think there is something, I've always said kind of the spice of spirituality is irreverent. You know, I just think that there's something very important about the function of balancing those. My favorite archetype is like the Joker or the Jester, you know, or the Coyote or whatever, whatever one resonates with you the most. But that kind of trickster myth is my favorite. Yeah,
the trickster.
I talk about this book, Trickster Makes This World, and it's a book I read by Lewis Hyde, I believe, is the author. And it's just so good. It's all about trickster mythology and art and how it's played out in our society and how important it is, that function. And even yesterday on Twitter, someone's like, you're a leader and you need to accept responsibility and tell your following to wear their masks. I'm like, I'm not a fucking leader. Can I swear?
Oh, please. It's encouraged. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not a leader though. I'm a comedian who stumbled ass backwards into the culture wars accidentally just by saying things that I felt like I wasn't saying for a weird reason. That's it. Yeah. Like, that's it. I'm a writer and a comedian. I don't want to be sent. And they're like, well, just cause you don't want to be a leader doesn't mean you're not. I'm like, no, you kind of have to want to be a leader to be one.
It is a choice.
I'm we're like, this is typical of any politician not taking any responsibility. I'm like, I'm not a politician either. I consider myself an artist and a writer and a creator. Like, well, I know that this is hard to conceive of in a culture that is progressively destroying art and does not see the function of it, whether it's institutional getting rid of art classes in school or whether it's progressives getting rid of UCB for whatever reason. It just seems like there's a war on the arts and people are and also now that everybody's locked up and they can't go see live music and they can't, you know, we're forgetting how important that shit is. And we're also expecting everybody to be everyone's looking for an authority. I'm like, what is this obsession with finding an authority everywhere?
But it's okay though, because we're home alone together. All over the world, Bridget. Why are you so cynical? We're home alone together and ABC is going to host it. So that's...
Here's what's really funny.
So I feel good about that.
Here's how disorganized this whole situation is. Two days ago, I got a notice from my gym that said, guess what? We don't have to wear gloves at the gym anymore. Hooray. You still have to wear masks though. We look forward to seeing you here. The next day, we're sorry to announce that the gym is closed. I'm like,
Governor Gavin.
One day apart.
It's Governor Gavin. It's not their fault.
No one has any idea what they're doing.
It's our pretty boy idiot governor. Right?
Yeah, he's a moron.
Okay, look. Back to you again, goddammit. Stop talking about other people. Stop. I need you to be more narcissistic.
It's a gift. Yeah. I'm like, whoo.
Be more of a drunk narcissist, okay? So like I asked you the question about when did you become, or how long have you been Bridget Fetisy? Because it seems to me that there's like a narrative that you've constructed, which is not false at all, but like of basically kind of, I mean, you could divide it into many ways, but your life has been sort of in two big phases. Like one is sort of the pre-political Bridget, who was also drunk, who was also, what were you, smoking weed, and you were a college dropout, and you were raped when you were 17, and your parents were divorced when you were 12, and you wanted to go, you dropped out, did I say college dropout? And you were waitressing, and you were just starting to do Twitter a little bit, but you weren't really into, you decided for some reason to improve your life. You thought it'd be a great idea to become political.
No, that's not what happened at all.
What kind of an idiot do I have in front of me? Like,
that's not what happened.
Do you understand those of us who are political are miserable wretches who should be put out of our misery?
Like,
this is no way to live, Bridget, and I want to get you out of here.
I'm trying to get out. Trust me.
Go back.
We need to go back. It's like Lost.
Yeah, seriously.
We need to go back.
Go to the other island where they don't talk about politics.
I'm trying. Trust me. My whole plan is to try and find that perfect escape velocity that will blast me back out of into the world where they're not all obsessed with politics. And I'm not sure how I can get through that, like, hate the whatever that collider is that they fucked everything up with over in Europe. Like, I need the sliding door back into the other reality. No, I didn't mean to get political. I came on Twitter because I was Twitter is a big part of the reason I got sober. I came on Twitter because I had been traveling around the world for 2 years and I was completely lost and didn't know what I was doing or what I wanted to do. I actually decided to take a class at UCB to show you what kind of rock bottom I was at.
Fucking racist. No.
I was hoping to join the Klan at UCB.
I just have a sour stomach feeling in my stomach right now. I don't know if I can do this anymore. Go on. Whatever. And go ahead. Go talk about yourself. Go ahead.
And then
we don't care about you anymore.
I went on Twitter and started noticing what people were using it for, but primarily in the comedy world. So I saw all the comedy writers, and that was what I moved here to do, was to be a comedy writer. And somebody dared me to do comedy, and that's how I ended up doing stand-up in 2010. And so I was like, oh, this is where all these people are, and I understand how they're using it. And then I just observed it for 2 weeks and read every study I could about it. And then I dove in because I was like, oh, this is just a giant high school. I didn't even know political Twitter existed. I had no idea. Because much like high school, those were just the fucking nerds that were off talking about, you know, running the school and shit. And I was busy figuring out how to get out of school and class.
Right. Yeah, me too.
Same thing on Twitter. I was like, all right, how do I, you know, it seemed like a fun game of, it was like a battle of the wits. That's what I thought it seemed like.
Yeah.
And that was, it did sharpen, I think, my ability to write jokes. And people who were managers were like, just every day write 10 jokes that are topical or 10 jokes and you'll just get the hang of it. And it came quite naturally to me because there's no filter between my brain. But then I started, you know, writing, if you're going to be writing things about, like for a late night packet, you start noticing things going on in the news because you have to. But aside from that, I ended up getting a job at Playboy, which was my dream, because when I was, one of my dreams, when it, in 2000, when I was living with my sister before I married the Belarusian, I wrote a whole package about how I wanted to write. I wrote Maxim a whole pitch about why I would be their perfect writer, because I'm a female with a brain's male. Now, in this day and age, someone might tell me I'm trans, and perhaps that's true. But back then it was just like, I'm a female who thinks like a dude.
Right.
And that, and I understand men. And so I wanted to write for Maxim. I came launching out into the Playboy world of 2015 with the mindset of a Gen X chick from Maxim in 2000. And it was a rude awakening. I did not know you couldn't say a lot of the things that you could say back in 2000.
Oh yeah. You were like bringing the 90s vibe into the 2000s.
Yes.
You didn't get the notification.
Oh,
the turn of the century there. Yeah. We don't do that anymore, honey. No. You got to put that, leave that back in 1998, you know?
Look, I'm even wearing a nice 90s-esque shirt.
I know. What's up with the shoulders?
I got no memos about how you can't say things like real man. I didn't get any memos about internalized misogyny. I didn't get any memos about the patriarchy. I was unaware.
You know what you didn't get the memo about? Most definitely was female pleasure.
Yeah.
Right. Because you talk a lot about pleasure, right? That runs throughout your narrative, right? Because it was, you know, heroin when you were a teenager, right? And then it was alcohol and weed, and it was sex, and then it was sex again with Playboy, right? And you talked about, wasn't your first piece on blowjobs and how there was actually,
yeah, it was empowering,
defending them, right? Against the feminists who were saying it was an act of patriarchal domination.
I'm writing this book right now, The Accidental Pundit, and it's all about this transition, which we are talking about. Yeah. And one of the funniest, I've been working on this chapter or this story, particularly of how I had tried so hard to become a writer. It's what I came out here for. And then I finally got my first freelance writing job ever paid since I had been writing a column in my hometown, which I also got in a lot of trouble for. So I don't know why I didn't see the writing on the wall then. But I then had to call my dad and be like, well, Dad, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is I got my first paid freelance piece.
I'm so glad, honey. That's so cool.
And I said, the bad news is it's called Why I Love Blowjobs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was not happy. And he was not, he wrote me like a 7-page handwritten letter, which was like, I hope you don't become known. I bet my dad wishes now that I'm known for what I'm known for, which is being a Nazi, I guess. Right. I bet he wishes.
Let's see. There's a woman who likes oral sex and there's a woman who's a Nazi. I'm trying to like balance, you know, the moral scales here. I don't know which is which.
He said he didn't want me to become known as a purveyor of smut. Ah. But I think now he wishes, because I'll never forget telling him that he's like, I'm like, Dad, there's some good news and some bad news. And he's like, what? And I'm like, well, the good news is I'm doing my first media on national television cable. And he was like, what's the bad news? I'm like, it's on Fox on the Ben Shapiro election special.
It just got worse and worse and worse.
And my dad is like a diehard liberal, and he was like, I hate you.
So basically, you're just a perverted Nazi, basically. That's
what, I guess. I don't know. I mean, they hate me too over in Naziville. They hate me. Oh, yeah. Oh. They can't stand me.
Why?
Because long before, they think that I was sent by the deep state to undermine the conservative party.
Oh, sweet. Sweet. They got a conspiracy theory about you. I want one.
And they believe that because they knew that I was writing for Playboy and showing my boobs online. And like, that was my whole thing, was all about sexuality and relationships and empowering yourself as a woman. Mm-hmm. And also finding that balance, because I really had a lot of problems with self-esteem. And I was working through a lot of that stuff and writing for Playboy, and I loved it. I had a brilliant editor, Joe Donatelli, who was the first man who probably ever gave me a break, and was just, I was so spoiled to have him as an editor because he was so genius. And then I started getting in trouble constantly internally with the social justice warriors at Playboy who were working inside Playboy.
Excuse me? There were social justice warriors inside Playboy?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Of course.
Did they take a wrong turn somewhere?
There's a whole conspiracy around Playboy that it got taken over from the inside by feminists and social justice warriors so they could basically like destroy it.
Like a another deep state operation?
A deep state operation to destroy the patriarchy.
I'm sure it's true.
I think it's more just a natural progression of young people coming in and coming out of college, and they all have different, you know, ideas about everything and men. And so I was really kind of the old guard of what I there weren't many of us who were still fighting the good fight. And eventually I started writing a couple. I think the first real political piece, quasi-culture political piece I ever wrote was, I really am a troublemaker. I wrote, Donald Trump is already making America great again. And we launched it on the day of the inauguration. And I was still shilling for the left, by the way, in this piece. I'm still saying, I just was saying, I'm worried that the left is so worried about being right that they would rather, they'd rather him be Hitler than them be wrong about him being Hitler.
That's right.
And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that we should look to the civil rights for how we can push back and not, anyway. It's held up, even though it's all been disappeared, because my whole body of work on Playboy has been memory holed.
Has it?
Yeah. There's like four things up that they have. And noticeably, they're the things that I mention on Joe Rogan. So I'm sure that it's just like for traffic, you know, like they know that I'm talking about it on a big platform and people are going to look for it.
Wait, they deleted your writing, your columns?
Allegedly. It was because of switching over the servers. And so all this stuff, they switched over servers and everybody got kind of memory hold. But what's, you know, Gavin McGinnis actually was like, oh yeah, they said the same thing to me at Vice. I was like, oh.
Yeah, I've written for many, many, many publications. I've never had that happen to me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you can't. I mean,
I've never heard of that happening.
I, like Gavin, probably had close to 100 articles. And I'm so proud of that body of work. It was a true humbling and amazing experience to be able to write for men like that. I learned so much about men, and I generally approach men with I guess the reason my readers loved me was because I approached it with compassion, but I just, you know, I was always so jealous of men and thought that they had it so much easier. And then I would put a call out on Twitter like, "Hey guys, I'm writing a piece about going bald. Will you email me?" And I would be weeping reading the emails for men just talking about their whole loss. And I'm like, oh my God, this is literally like losing its grief. They go through the 7 stages of grief when they're going through this. And I had no idea. And then same thing with like any kind of premature ejaculation or any kind of problems. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And being short and that struggle. I mean, there were just so many things that I took for granted. I just thought all men had it easier. And when I started really listening, reading, I mean, and these men would write me thousands of words. It was like nobody was asking them how they were doing. And that was the other thing I was noticing as the culture was becoming more anti-male and telling everybody, you know, I didn't understand this. There seemed, and I kept pushing back against this even with people on the left. Like, you guys are constantly telling me that there's this toxic masculinity and that they're not allowed to have their feelings. And in the same breath, you'll tell them to shut the fuck up and sit down and be quiet. And they've had enough time to talk. So which one is it? That's a very mixed message that you're sending to men in general. And when I would ask men, "Hey, what do you think about this? Or how are you doing?" It was like no one was asking them this. And they would send me these essays and they were moving. I mean, I still have so many of them. And I learned, I just loved that body of work. And because they're, what do you call it? Like, they just are copyright. I don't know. Like, there's nothing I can really do about it.
They own it.
Yeah, pretty much. But even though it doesn't exist.
Those fucks. to not publish it and to still sit on it with the copyright and not.
They sent me a cease and desist for posting a screenshot of it on my private Patreon because I blasted it on Twitter and I was like, oh, because I still have all the articles because I am a witch and I had a gut instinct. I just was like, this shit's gonna be gone.
Good.
And it was when I was kind of moving, my profile was rising just because the right wing was suddenly retweeting me and whatever. And I just had this gut instinct that I needed. So I texted my cousin. I'm like, screenshot all my work. I was like, go on Playboy and just take screenshots of every single piece. And thank God she did. And then it was gone like 2 days later. It was just like all gone. And so I still have it, which is good. I mean,
I'm shocked. Seriously, I didn't know this about you. God damn. Wow. And so who runs Playboy now?
I don't even know who runs it. It's not
it's Cooper. No longer
the family's done. Yeah. No, they're pretty much gone.
Right.
And I really have no idea who runs it. And
so what did you write about that would cause your typical SJW to bury you?
I mean, the first piece, it's funny. So I kept begging them to give me a column, and that because that was my dream always with Maxim, was to have a column. And then Joe, at the end of I started writing for them in April of 2015, and then going into 2016, Joe was like, "Hey, we have a great idea. Why don't you write a column for us?" And kind of tongue in cheek. And so he said, "Pitch me a bunch of ideas, and then I'll pick one for you to write." And the one he picked, of course, was the hardest, which was seducing men. It was women date assholes because you're a pussy.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this won't be that hard to write. And then once I got into it, it was kind of challenging to thread that needle in a way that I was happy and content with. And I knew Joe from comedy barely, but he somehow got wind of that piece when I posted it and retweeted it.
You're talking about Rogan now.
Yeah, Rogan. Oh, okay. So okay, then yeah, it just blew up my first one, and it was kind of a trial. And I was like, I thanked him the last time I was on. I was like, so thank you, because you inadvertently probably made it possible for me to have my column. Because it was like my trial column, and then it just like blew up. And
so hang on,
people were mad.
What was the argument in that piece? Because I've heard you talk about it, but I never quite understood the argument.
Basically, so way back in 2000, I was the Buddyhead girl. I don't know if you remember Buddyhead.com. It was the music site back in 2000. And it was right when the internet was, Travis Keller, who is the kind of genius behind that site, was so far ahead of the curve with the internet. Uh-huh. And he came to LA and was really deep in the music scene. And they had this gossip column, and it was everybody read this gossip column. And they would do crazy things like sneak into Fred Durst's office and steal his hat and then auction it for like domestic abuse survivors, like auction it online. They were like very punk rock. And I somehow, they needed an intern when I first moved here right out of rehab. It was bad in the Valley. I left for 3 months and then came back determined to like have a different experience, which I did. I worked with autistic kids, and I also worked as, this is like the first time it occurred to me that I could be a writer. Mm-hmm. Writing just was something I always did. I didn't know that I could do it. And so then I got this internship, and I also got to write a sex column. The one question I got the most often was, why do women date assholes? Over and over again, hundreds of times. And then when I went back to Playboy, it was the same thing. Why do women date assholes? And I'm like, women, it's because you're a pussy. And so
The women are pussies or the men are pussies?
Men are pussies.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's always like, and so I was saying in this piece that it's never, the guys who are saying, oh, whining about why women are dating assholes are usually men who are kind of trying to like back end their way into a relationship by being friends with a girl instead of just being up front. Oh. And then I was talking about just alpha males in general. And how they're just not elf. And you can't say that. I didn't know. I didn't get the memo. I didn't know you couldn't say things like real man. I didn't know you couldn't say things. I was like, I want somebody who can protect me in the apocalypse. It didn't go well. Uh-huh. But that was my first experience of getting piled on by both sides, because the men's right activists came after me for basically making fun of beta males. And social justice came after me for internalizing toxic masculinity and perpetuating all these stereotypes about what a real man should be.
I have an announcement for unregistered listeners about the podcast, so please don't fast forward. I have a new show. It's called Unregistered Live. It's every Thursday night, but it's only for members of the Unregistered Underground, which is the supporting listeners group for the podcast. But we have a whole new set of benefits for that group. Not only do you get access to Unregistered Live, where it's a Zoom meeting, you can talk to me, ask questions, debate me, yell at me. We talk about all the inside stories about Unregistered, all the guests who've come on, various episodes. It's a total blast. It is, I am telling you the truth, the highlight of my whole week. Ask anyone who's a member. The new Underground, though, includes not only access to Unregistered Live every Thursday night with me, you also get access to our very popular private Facebook discussion group, which has been going on for about 3 years now. It is booming. There's discussions every day about all kinds of subjects in there, and I join in quite often as well. You also now, as a member of the Underground, get a free Renegade University tour account, which gives you free access to one lesson from each one of our courses, as well as access to the Quad, which is our proprietary internal social media platform. So, to support this podcast and to join the Unregistered community and to see me every Thursday night if you want to, please go to unregisteredunderground.com and become a member at either the monthly level or the annual level. I think you'll see when you get there, it is quite a deal for what you're getting. Thank you so much. Yeah. So when you say a real man, what do you mean?
From my perspective, it's somebody I feel safe in an alley with. Just want to feel safe. That's it.
Oh, physically safe?
I'm tiny. I'm 5'2". So I'm very conscious of, I have like a lot of weird, I'm always worried about getting trampled in crowds. I don't like big crowds. I'm the first one going down in the crowd. It's stampeding.
So you just should like be married to like bouncers and stuff, like huge.
I really only date dudes who are, I mean, my cousins always make fun of me because, or they get mad. They're like, stop taking all the tall guys. Like, you don't get to take the tall guys. You're short. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but I need somebody to pull me out of a stampede.
Which is these days, you know, actually, especially
pretty reasonable.
Especially wherever you are, there could be a stampede at any moment, right?
Yes.
Against you. So you probably,
I mean,
need
a- I also have a lot of like weird apocalypse. And it's funny, I went on a show and it was a show about sex and relationships, but she had read my entire body work on Playboy and she was like, there's a theme I want to call you out on. And it's there's a very apocalypse theme in a lot of your work. And it is this kind of ongoing like preparedness and how I'm like, when the dollar, she read me all these quotes, like when the dollar falls and when the grid goes down, like, but now that we're living in somewhat of a, when there's a global pandemic and we're all on house arrest,
you need to have some sort of polyamorous relationship with like SEAL Team 6 or something, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. You need like dudes who can carry you through when shit goes down, right?
I've been with guys who are handy like that, and I have a lot of respect for it.
They're handy at shooting zombies, or Muslims in faraway countries, one or the other.
No, I mean guys who can like build a house or start. I was with a guy who could, you know, his whole thing was like taking, you know, kids out into the woods. It sounds way worse going into it, but it was like those
and beating the shit out of them.
No, you know, those wilderness camps for kids that are bad, where you take them out, but teach them
and
how to like go live in the backcountry and they can't flee. And if they do, you have to get a helicopter.
Right.
I knew a lot of those kids.
Oh God.
But just being able to survive. I have a weird, maybe it's my upbringing or what. It's definitely like some kind of weird psychology. I'm always like, I'm a fucking prepper at heart.
So, okay. So real man means big man.
Tall man.
Oh, just tall? They don't have to be like football players big?
They don't have to be jacked. I know a lot of like very squirrely men like who are strong and could kick the crap out of someone.
Hell yeah. Okay.
They're like ninjas. They just have to be a ninja who can build a fire in the woods, protect me from zombies, and possibly hunt for food. Look, I grew up in the Midwest.
Where?
I'm from
Where is that man? Where is
There's tons of men like this in America.
Who can find food in the woods? They can't find food at Walmart, Bridget.
They can.
Those fat fucks in the middle of the country, are you kidding me? Do you think
you're
can,
from San Francisco. I don't expect you to know about the flyover state.
Did you just call me a faggot? You did, didn't you? This is done. I'm out of here. Goodbye. Bridget Phetasy destroyed on podcast after calling host faggot. I don't know. I don't know where to go now. Let's see.
I don't know where to.
I mean, I feel a little bit better, like that. You don't need like the big hulking dudes because I'm like 6'1", but I'm like skinny. So I have a thing that my insecurity is like being too skinny. You know,
what is your survival capacity?
See, the whole like hunting and gathering and like shooting deer with bows and stuff. I don't know. I could probably give it a go. I don't think I can.
You think
really
you could figure it out? You know, what would be your role in a society that's breaking down? And
okay,
would you be able to catch a squirrel and start a fire and cook it?
I swear to God, I thought about exactly this question last night. I swear to God. So I I've heard about men who like have said, who've been in wars, who have said that what troubled them the most about themselves is that they were at their best in war, in combat, right? And I was thinking, I mean, I'm sure I could do all the things just as well as anybody, you know, I could shoot and fight and all those things, right? But like, I'm pretty sure I would suck because I'd be so emotionally devastated just hearing one bullet pop. Like I couldn't even go on. Like,
maybe you could be the therapist for everybody who is losing their mind and the kind of trying their psyches broke as to what was happening around them. You could be the person that helped them assimilate into the new conditions.
I'll be like your chaplain, you know, where
sure.
I'm there to help. Well, because there's no shrinks in the military. You're gonna need a military, and you need a chaplain. That's what the chaplain.
I'm going back to like even pre-military. I'm thinking you're the shaman.
Ooh. Oh hell yeah! Oh fuck yeah! I got that. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I already kind of am, so we could do that.
Yeah.
So I mean, think in a pinch, sure, I could fight somebody for you.
Yeah, there's. I think there's. It's funny. It's interesting the world we live in now, where the nerds really have won. It is Revenge of the Nerds because it's all technology and it's all paper. Yep. You know, it's all ones and zeros and just they've taken over to a certain extent. But what this pandemic and this whole moment in time and the riots and the looting and all of the stuff that's going on reveals to me, that which I already am deeply aware of all the time, is that society is a very thin, you know, fragile exterior to absolute chaos. It's an agreement we're all making, essentially.
Yeah.
Not saying anything your audience doesn't already know. But that's why now
sure they do on one level, but it's never been stated explicitly like that. So that's great to do it. Because yes, like the recent upheavals was just a glimpse of what can happen. And if people in core institutions in a society start to think that those institutions are meaningless or corrupt, then we could have rioters in the streets who are from those institutions, and then society's gone.
Right.
Right now we just have 20-year-olds for the most part, right? Who don't have a job even, much less the institution behind them. But once the institutions start to come down, which I do think is, I don't know if we were recording this or was before we started recording, but this new generation coming out of colleges, they're going to be more and more like the AOCs and the Ilhan Omars, and they're going to be more identitarian, and they're going to be more SJW and all that stuff. And they're going to be more about canceling people for having bad ideas, et cetera, et cetera. And they're going to be in Congress and the New York Times and in all the colleges they already are. And then, I don't know. I mean, that's basically this formation is happening right now.
Right.
Where you have this new identity left politics fully inhabiting these major institutions. And that's really new, just like in the last few years since Trump, basically. And then you have the rest of society looking at this like, there's no way to relate. Like, I used to be able to read the New York Times, like to get through it. I could get through it. And now I can't even really get through it.
But as somebody mentioned to me, I think it was Michael Malice, actually, he was like, but this is your enemy, the guy in the tutu? Like, this is who you're going to be fighting? And this is goes to my original point that I don't know if we're recording, where we were talking about how America has shown an enormous amount of restraint as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Because I am from, so I was born on the East Coast, and then I went through many of my preteen and then teenage years in Minnesota.
Okay.
And I deeply respect and feel connected to that Midwestern heritage that I have and all of my friends and families there. And because I still have so many connections there, I knew Trump was going to win. And also just understand that the psychology that we see playing out online on Twitter among these media elites, I'm like, here's a fun thing. Go try and explain the letter to somebody who's not on Twitter, like my brother who works as a fireman or somebody who's actually keeping society together. Right. Go try and explain it to them and listen to how fucking dumb you sound. Yeah. Me even, you know, just as I was trying to explain to my cousin Maggie, who's a normie and doesn't pay attention to anything. And I was like, I feel like throwing up in my mouth for even talking about this. But on the other hand, it's deeply terrifying and chilling and unsettling what I'm seeing. But it's also a lot of media elites arguing. So it's a weird juxtaposition of things that's happening. And it's easy to dismiss as just media elites at these big institutions who are kind of having these highfalutin fights, but you're seeing people self-censoring and the chilling effect of that all over America, not just in New York and San Francisco and LA. So I don't know. It's funny. My cousin and I always end our podcasts with a check-in, And it always, we know the check-in is done because we'll be talking about the apocalypse inevitably. Just, but now that we're kind of in pre-apocalypse, I guess.
Yeah.
This is like the prequel to the apocalypse.
We are totally gearing up for it. Yeah. We're practicing. We're practicing. Yeah.
It's like, I kept calling it apocalypse light. I'm like, we're on our couches. I said on Twitter, I'm like, it's not an apocalypse if you're getting fat.
Or if you know the bougie restaurant scenes, like it's like a pop-up apocalypse, you know, just like, it's here for a few days, but then it's gone.
It's a little bit light. It's not, you know, you're on your couch watching Netflix. You still have things being delivered. Right. For me, it's like fighting in the streets. You know, I'm looking around like this, how defensible is this place? And like, I need to get somewhere that's a little more fortified. And is there a source of water nearby? And
totally. No, you really go deep with this.
Oh, I do.
That's why you like Rogan, because he's all about the crossbow.
Oh my God. I love Rogan. Rogan is my spirit animal. I just love him so much. He's not tall, though.
I want you to know
I said, you don't need to be tall.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
in order to pull me out of the, you probably need to be a little tall.
Okay, now you're confusing me. I don't know what your politics are anymore. I don't know what kind of men you like. I don't know what to do.
I do respect his, he is, I guess maybe it's that like Gen X thing, but he really is representative to me of that just idea of the real dude, the real man, of just somebody who could like, who is into dude stuff and was fine with being into dude stuff and doesn't feel the need to apologize and can go, you know, likes to go hunt food and likes to do dude things, like lift heavy things.
You definitely
see, he could pull me out of a stampede.
Oh, you want Joe Rogan in the apocalypse?
He can
lift.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's the colonel in my army for sure. You know.
Yeah.
Captain. All right. I have a couple of things I want to do with you before we close this out. I am trying to figure out your politics, and I definitely hear some strains of what could be called like old liberalism, like pre-identity liberalism. I also hear definite strains of conservatism, just straight up old-fashioned conservatism.
Interesting. I don't know enough about conservatism to know what those would be.
Yeah, we can talk about it. And perhaps like little sprinkling of libertarianism too. So, but that could mean you just have your own ideology, which is the best of all, right? I mean, I think you have your own particular hybrid going on.
I feel that I'm truly an independent in the sense that I take everything on a case by case basis. And this election is proving to be very challenging for me because I really hate voting for, I feel like it only encourages bad candidates when you have to suck it up and vote for someone you hate. And for whatever reason that might be. And so I also feel like voting is a true right that I don't take for granted. And I don't want to just piss my vote away, but I might. I might just be like, fuck it, I don't care. I'm not voting this year. And I live in California, so it doesn't matter anyway. Which people get mad at me and say, it does matter, every vote counts. And then it matters because you could be a voice. I'm like, whatever. like the world is burning. Anyway, and I did not know, and another thing I'm writing about. I never questioned my liberal upbringing. I was raised a very blue blood, along with alcohol and Jesus, like the Kennedys. Were, yeah, it was. Yeah. That was the Holy Trinity in my house growing up.
The everyone's favorite Irish Catholic drunks.
Oh yeah, that my dad's one of 10. My dad actually and his family, they were like the Irish Von Trapp family singers.
Totally.
And they sang for the Kennedys.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
No one knows. I don't think I've ever talked about this, but
Oh wow.
Yeah. So they were on the Ted Sullivan, you know, show and the Ed Sullivan show and the Ted Mac Amateur Hour. Am I getting those right?
I don't know. Ed Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan and the Ted Mac Amateur Hour, I believe.
I don't know that one. Okay. Wow.
My grandfather before he nearly died of alcoholism, had an amazing voice, and all the kids sang, and there were 10 of them, so they did the whole like Sound of Music. It was crazy.
Wow. So you go back with that crew. Have you ever seen Teddy Kennedy in person?
No.
He was like a walking embodiment of alcoholism. Like he had the biggest head I've ever seen.
And the big red nose.
I have a really big head, but his head was like this and all red. And he just was like clearly an alcoholic. And they die all the time. They had just two more die a couple weeks ago riding a boat. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's sad. They're cursed. So yeah, I don't think I ever questioned it. I thought about this a lot. I don't know that. I'm sure I knew people who were pro-life, but it was never even something I thought that much about, because it was something that was so, you're pro-choice, you know, just what it was like.
I thought you were raised Catholic.
Yeah, that's why it's weird, because it was raised Catholic.
Someone else didn't get the memo. Right.
It was more of that like new kind of liberal Catholicism, I feel. And then I just always voted blue. I was writing about this just the other night about how I didn't think I was rich enough or poor enough to care about politics. And largely, now that I know more, I was right. That's right. I was right about that when I was drunk and didn't know anything. And now I know a little bit more, and I still believe I'm not rich or poor enough to care about politics. Because it doesn't really matter to me. I'm still just a cog in the wheel, making the rich richer and paying for the poor. That's just my place in society. I've accepted it.
That's dark. I mean, especially for someone who has 220,000 Twitter followers.
I'm a cog.
Jeez, you're not.
Yeah,
a
but
cog.
I'm still not rich. You know, I'm not poor either. I'm not poor enough to care about what the state thinks about me, and I'm not rich enough to care about taxes.
Right. it makes you super special.
I'm a normie. I'm a normal American. I'm just a red-blooded American.
In a way, that's what you are. You are representing like normie non-college types in their reactions to all this weirdness that's coming out of these Ivy League places, right?
I've come up with a term for us.
Let's do it.
The moron majority.
I mean, I like retarded better, but okay. You know, morons, okay. Why? Oh, because
I only speak for myself, and perhaps I'm a majority of one. But I'm the apolitical person who is just grinding along. I'm grateful that I had, and I'm like, I'm a fucking moron. I know nothing. Maybe I should have studied with my ex-husband when he was getting his citizenship, because I fucking don't know anything about how this country works.
Wait.
Like from my fifth grade education that I clearly forgot in all the blackouts.
Do you know how a bill is passed, Bridget?
I think I understand now, but I don't know that I did like 6 years ago. And I'm not sure that I could explain it if I was pressed.
Do you know who your congressperson is, Bridget?
Not really.
See this? Yeah. It's probably Adam Schiff. Or it could be.
Wait, is it?
It's some horrible person. I know that. It's either Adam Schiff or the other guy. I don't know what part of town you're in, but...
Wait, no, I thought it was Feinstein.
Oh, the senator. Your senator is dying.
My senator. And
the congressperson. Oh, boy.
God.
So I think... Okay, we'll just stop this conversation right now.
No. I was just confused for a minute there.
No, guess what?
I don't actually know.
I never
know. No, I do know. I looked this up. I think it's Lou.
Who?
Ted?
Oh, Ted. Oh, really? Is he in?
I think it is.
Is he LA? I don't know who's in LA. I thought he was up
here. Yeah, I think it is. No, okay. See, I'm not, I'm really not as bad at this as I used to be, even if I did just confuse my senator with my congressman. But
let me tell you,
I did have to look this up.
I rarely know who the mayor or congressperson is where I'm living. So
I know the mayor.
I rarely know my own mayor. I rarely know my own congressperson.
And then the other congresswoman, it's a woman, because I live in a weird district where it was hard for me to even figure out which person it was, because I live kind of in a gray zone. Uh-huh. But I can't remember her name either. I'm just bad with names too. Being bad with names and trying to be in politics is not a good thing. Like trying to understand and remember any of it. And I say I'm open about how I'm just a moron about politics. And so I've been trying to play catch up, and I think I probably know more than I think I know, but it's much like when you're learning a language and you don't want to speak the language for fear of sounding like an idiot. Mm-hmm. I just am like, I'm an idiot and don't know that much, because I will make dumb mistakes like I just did. And then I'm like, nah, I don't know anything.
Do you want me to tell you, let me tell you what I always told my students, like, and I still do, like, knowledge is so easy to teach and so easy to learn. I can teach a monkey who the congressperson is, like literally, like there are chimps that are that intelligent. They can identify, you know, a human being.
Right? Thanks. I get it. I'm a moron.
Hold on. So like, you know, these
I could teach a chimp the difference between a congresswoman and a senator.
I'm about to compare. Bridget. No, I'm about to. Okay, hold on. Just give me a second. Let me finish.
I'm kidding.
So that's easy. Like, and that's like why these autistic people who have like all the knowledge of all the things ever are so annoying to me, because they often have nothing interesting to say about the knowledge. So what I've always valued is intelligence and being able to say, and creativity. So if you take a piece of information that I hand you, Ted Lieu is your congressperson, right? It's not whether or not you remember that information that's important to me. It's whether you have something interesting to me to say about Ted Lieu, which you definitely do. As soon as you learn anything about Ted Lieu, you, Bridget, could go and write a damn book probably about it, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I got thrown into this, and you know, I was
thrown joking. Into it. You chose it. What do you mean thrown into it?
I didn't choose this.
Women have agency.
Yes.
Except you.
We do have agency. I don't think I chose, you know, people will say on my show Dumpster Fire on YouTube, they'll be like, this is where I get my news. And you're the only person that I listen to now who's like, I'm like, no, don't listen to me. I don't even know who my congressman is. I didn't even know that English was not a romance language until somebody in all the Actually Boys told me last week in my comments after I made a joke. I don't know anything really. And I really have been, you know, I've been taking these like free courses online, just trying to reacquaint myself with the Constitution and the Federalist Papers and all of these different. And I just feel so, the more I learn, the more humbled and dumb I feel. I just feel there's so much to learn about so much. And I was a great student. I love academia. I thrived in academia. I wanted to go to Harvard. It came easily and naturally to me. And I love history. I love it. But politics never really grabbed my attention. And I've realized why I never liked it. Although I don't think I could have articulated it then. And it's because largely it is not aspirational. It is dirty. And people are mean. And now that I know way more about politics than I ever wanted to, and have been thrown into the culture wars in ways in which I'm trying to keep up and seeing the way behind the scenes and a lot of, you know, behind the curtain a little bit with the media and with these campaigns, I feel gross. It makes me feel dirty. And I think I always got that vibe from politics that it was dirty. And it doesn't inspire me. It's never been something that I felt really passionate or moved by. So I still feel that way. And hence, to circle completely back, like, that's why I want out. I like writing about the culture, but I'm much more interested and engaged and inspired by the battle I've had to fight against myself to get out of my own way. And that's more inspiring to me to see other people doing that and bettering themselves, because I feel like it's very much the rooms, you know, that idea that, and therapy, like, this is all an inside job, and Buddha, just all of it. And amen. So, yeah, that's why I guess it's funny how the things that just don't interest you just don't stick in your brain, or in mine at least.
That's
like,
right.
I cannot hold that information in my brain. Although I am really fascinated with the founding and just, it's been fun to have to relearn all that stuff as an adult. Hmm. And it's also why I think college is wasted on the young.
Hmm. Okay. So you're interested in history and the founding of this country. So I have written about this, and I have written something that you might be interested in. In fact, what I've written about is in a sense about you, because it's about this conflict in American culture between pleasure and individual freedom on one side,
mm-hmm.
and citizenship,
mm-hmm.
and its obligations on the other, right? Because citizenship is not just about rights. People don't know this. People think it's just about voting. You get right. to do stuff. No, citizenship culturally has always meant, and I don't like this part of it, right? Has always meant saluting, deference to authority, mm-hmm. being a good upstanding citizen, being sober, being hardworking, being mm-hmm. industrious, being a family member in the nuclear family, right? Being disciplined and organized all the time. And the founding fathers found that in early America, Americans were a bunch of fucking drunks. I don't know if you know how much people were drinking in the 18th century, but it was like, oh yeah, they would drink basically the equivalent of about a pint to a quart of whiskey per day.
Wow.
Yeah, the average adult in America in 1776 was drinking that much.
Wow.
And the founding, and then there was just like fucking like all over the place. So prostitution mm-hmm. was like not punished, and mm-hmm. there was lots of reports of like sex in the streets of Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. It was a very libertine mm-hmm. moment in American history. And the founding fathers come along, they're like, fuck this. We need like an army. We need, because we want to take over. We want to take over this place, right? And also, here's the thing, we want to have it be at least partly democratic, which means giving obviously the power to some of the people. But then they were like, whoa, wait a minute. That can't happen if they're a bunch of drunks and fornicators. But at the same time, they were like this. They said, wait, democracy, though, if we give them the country, these people, they hoped that would actually force them to discipline themselves, because they'd be like, whoa, we got to manage this place, right? Mm-hmm. I got to shape up. And in fact, you see like in the 19th century, you see the rise. There's still tons of drinking, but you see the rise of coffee culture
mm-hmm.
right after the revolution, and sort of the decline of some of the tavern culture. And you see the founding fathers all talking about coffee instead of drinking, even though they were a bunch of drunks. So there's this tension within democracy, right? Because if you really are going to run a country, you can't be partying. You have to be super duper disciplined, right? This is why socialists are all about like proletarian revolutionary discipline, because it's like all the workers are going to run the factories. Well, you can't be a bunch of drunks doing that.
Right.
So when I think about your life and your career, in a sense, I see sort of the same tension, right? Because you start off with this attachment to pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You start off with the heroin when you were a teenager, and then the drinking, and you called yourself hypersexual at the time, and then drinking and weed and all the stuff we've been talking about. And then you hit your 30s, and then you start to come out of that into politics, right? Yeah. You start to become a participant in politics in sort of a democratic way, sort of like in a very broadly, you know, democratic way. And you stop drinking. And you stop using, and you stop smoking. Yeah. And I'm wondering, so I see that arc in you, and I'm just wondering, like, to me, I know more about someone's politics based on what they think of pleasure and especially sex than anything else. Like, if I know what your position on pleasure and sex is, I can probably figure out whether I'm gonna like you politically. So I'm trying to figure you out on this question. Like, what are you thinking about the relationship between like pleasure and the good life?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting too, that tension that you describe exists in me from being raised and born on the East Coast and in a very rebellious, independent family that embodied that spirit of but then moving to the Midwest and having this work. All my best friends and their families were very Scandinavian and German, and that kind of work ethic was really deeply instilled in me just by osmosis of living in the Midwest for all those years mm-hmm. and being around it and seeing that devotion to family that my friends have. You know, it just was something. Our family's so independent. There's 5 kids in my family. There's 10 of my dad's. Everybody's very close, but everybody's very much like live and let live, do whatever you want. And they also wouldn't expect you to come take care of them if you were sick or something like that. They would kind of, it's very much like, no, we got this. And mm-hmm. it's just a different culture in the Midwest with my friends and their families. And I really love and respect that, that family centric, even if I didn't experience it myself, just being exposed to it was good for me, I think, just yeah. seeing that modeled. And I joke about this all the time, how when you first get sober, when I first got sober, they said you aren't even going to recognize yourself in 5 or 6 years if you stay sober. You, and I was like, I looked around and I was like, I'm a conservative? Like, how much fucking weed was I smoking? Because I, when I sobered up, I was a liberal. And like, what happened? And it, a lot of it is the culture just moving, but also suddenly to my surprise, I'm being welcomed by the conservative party. But then the minute they open their mouths about like porn and sex, I'm like, yeah. Oh no, thank God. Woo. Right. Not one of you.
Right.
So I just, I don't ever feel like I can identify with that. And then they'll kind of, I see this all the time now. They'll be going after the left for their puritanical. They're like, oh, here's the left ruining all the fun. And they're going to, they're mm-hmm. going to take, they're going to take these like girls and they'll make the lingerie bowl filled with like men and all, and overweight women. And they're going to take all the fun out of everything and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you guys are like the OG prudes. So spare me the moral lecturing. And by the way, I got shit from all of you because allegedly feminism is the death of society if you really drill down in some of the right wing ideas and talking points. And
yes,
it's been the scourge of Western culture, and mm-hmm. that my freedom and the fact that I'm 41 and I don't have a baby means that I'm somehow like basically the equivalent of a witch back in the old days, but I'm like a defective and I'm an example. You know, I can send you essays that people have written about me online from the right wing. They're not, they're more fringe, but they've written entire psychological breakdowns of how I had a fucked up stepdad and, you know, I had too much sex and I never got serious about a relationship, and now I'm just a sad individual, and this is what's wrong with all of society, and I'm like the poster child for it, and this comes from the right wing. So when I need to remind myself often that that exists there too, because now on the left wing, I'm considered, it is weird, like the pure, that's what's so disorienting to me, is that I think that was, and a lot of it, what I've really had to watch out for in this weird journey, very publicly, of A, getting sober, growing up and learning about the Constitution and our country, you know, and a lot of people will give me shit. They're like, why are you even talking if you don't know this? Why are you even talking about feminism if you don't know anything about feminism? I'll get from the left. Or why are you even talking about the First Amendment if you don't know the Constitution by heart? And like, I would say, look at everyone online. It doesn't seriously. Seem to stop anyone else or our president. Mm-hmm. And it's been, I've really had to watch out for reacting to rejection. Because I moved a lot growing up, and I know my own psychology of always feeling like the new girl and always kind of wanting to belong and always feeling like I was on the outside looking in and never feeling a part of. And I even get emotional still talking about it, and sitting at lunch alone and feeling rejected and doing a lot of things out of that sense of rejection, you know, drink, and when I was feeling rejected by my peers in comedy, in LA, in the left wing, as I was being more honest, that was very painful. And it would have been easy for me to be working at the Blaze right now, you know, and just go like all in on Fox News or whatever. It would have, I can see how that would have easily been. And it would have been a reaction to being rejected. And so I've always had to keep checking myself with making sure that I'm not just lashing out at the left because they're rejecting me. Mm. And I'm not taking, you know, somebody said something to me that really stuck out, and it was during the transitionary period when I was growing a lot and getting a lot of unwanted attention because from both the right and the left. And I was like, the left thinks I'm a Nazi, and it's not, they think I'm carrying water for Trump, and it's not like I'm saying anything. It's not like I'm doing that. And he said, it's not what you're saying, it's what you're not saying. And that stuck with me forever, because that was how I ended up in the middle. That's how I ended up getting kicked out of the left, really, was I observed what I was not saying. And I think this is how people become slaves to their audience without even realizing that they're doing so, is they start getting accolades for saying one thing, and then you stop saying things that might upset the audience that you have gathered by saying the thing that got you accolades. Mm-hmm. And that's why Iowa Hawk, who's one of my favorite followers on Twitter, he goes, the only way to do Twitter and to do this whole thing and be in this space is to immediately say the opposite of whatever you just got a lot of followers for directly mm-hmm. after you did. It's the only way to like keep your following honest.
That's what I did.
And yourself honest. And I've had to check myself on that, because I think it really would have been easy out of rejection to run into the loving and welcoming open arms of the right wing that wanted to weaponize me, essentially. And that would have been a mistake. You know, I have learned a lot, and I love people that are called Nazis. They've given me platforms, and we can, the thing I do love about the right wing is they'll sit down and have a conversation with me, even if we don't agree on things. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I have not necessarily been extended that benefit.
But that's only because they're out of power.
Mm.
Don't forget that. I mean, I have had the same experience, and I do love the same people you're talking about. We've been on the same shows, right?
Yeah.
But, and I'm not talking about Rogan and Dave Rubin. I'm talking about like other people. But like the hard right, the reason they're so friendly, I think, is that, again, they're out of power. Once they take power, they've got to keep the ship orderly, right? And they're going to be cracking down too.
Right. I wonder though, because a lot of these people, I've seen what people have said to them just for even elevating me, you know, like Glenn Beck and people who have a very religious and right-wing audience. They will give them a lot of shit for having a Playboy writer on, and for, right. or a feminist, or somebody who's pro-choice, or somebody who's any, you know, all these things that they, and they are willing to take that hit, even though they're it might cost them money, or it might cost them an audience, you know, an audience member, people give them grief for that. So I do respect that they're willing to take those risks and take those hits, especially if they're out of power.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. I just mean like the Republicans and the right wing will be a lot less fun when they have power. But I wanted to, I guess, close by like, when you're talking about your childhood, it really hit me. And not just your childhood, but like really your career too. And this experience of recurring ostracism.
Yeah. And
social isolation.
I get like, it's like right here.
Yeah. Well,
you
I
know,
mean,
like, I'm not going to cry on this podcast, but I might.
Well, I'll cry before you. I've been known to cry on this podcast. Many times, you know, for a lot of obvious reasons lately, I've been thinking about this question a lot, and it's pretty clear both what's going on in society and what's going on in my own life. But like, I'm pretty clear now that the worst form of punishment for me, at least, and I think for a lot of people, is social isolation.
Yeah.
So there's a man, I don't know if you know, I've never talked about this publicly. And I have nothing to do with it, but it's just so upsetting that I can't. He's like, he's probably some kind of white supremacist, but there's a guy in the Supermax prison in Colorado. I forget his name. He's a white guy. I forget his name, but he's been in solitary confinement with no access to any other human being for something like 2 decades now.
What?
And they did it because he killed a guard 20 something like decades ago.
That's
He's a famous guy. He's well known. You can look it up. He's in the season. And I think about him a lot. Like, there's a human being even though I'm sure he's not the nicest guy in the world, right? But like, that definitely, and the guards did it deliberately, and they've been allowed to do this because they have to send a message. And I've heard them say this, we have to send a message that that is, you get the ultimate punishment.
Okay, but that's like very extreme.
It's worse than killing.
Yeah.
Right? So, and then, you know, the quarantine, and your Twitter has been like a beacon during this, right? Like this, just today you tweeted this beautiful thing about how you're one of the few people like me who's been really concerned about the mental health of people during this, right?
Yeah, very concerned.
I know my mental health has declined. I've seen it all around me and I keep hearing this. Where was I going with this? I forgot where
that social ostracism.
Yeah, so that's what was done to you when you were a kid. Mm. It's what was done to you when you were a kid, maybe as punishment or not, I don't know. And then it certainly was done to you as an adult as punishment for sure when you got into politics. And I know a lot of listeners to this show have had very similar experiences. I know that I have had very similar experiences, both as again, like with society and inside my own family. I think it's the worst thing you can do to someone.
I do believe it's interesting because I went through, there was a moment in my family and yeah, it's probably the closest I've ever come to killing myself, truly. And my whole family, I didn't talk to any, they all kind of didn't talk to me and turned on me, and it's way too private and personal to get into, but it was dark. And I remember there was a month where I was really isolated and I felt completely abandoned, you know, the abandonment thing runs deep, and betrayed in many ways, which is also a deep, like, core wound that I probably still deal with regularly. And I found a lot of power in that month being alone. I went real deep into myself and just finding, it was way before I got sober, and many years later I did, but I feel like the seeds of it were very much sown in that moment. And I, even now, what I do on Twitter when I feel my blood boiling or I start, the most dangerous, there are dangerous places psychologically for me to go. One is into this cul-de-sac in which I've locked off, that we're kind of like skirting by right now, where I've like closed that neighborhood down and I just try not to visit it unless I'm with a therapist.
Right.
The other is nihilism in general. Like nihilism for me is deadly because when I get on that train and it ends at the station of nothing matters,
yes,
I'm in big trouble. Me not too. Just for drinking, because it will lead me to drink. It will lead me, resentment is trouble. You know, all those feel envy, those are troublesome, but nihilism is very dark for me. And because it's so connected to hopelessness, and that is, I know, recently I've been thinking a lot about this loss of art, because the moments when there was a school shooting, I used to always go to a museum. It was just like my automatic habit. I'd be like, get offline and go to a museum. And there I would see art, and I would see also, especially like out at the Getty, at the Getty Villa, there's all of the old, the wars and the stuff. It's just humanity. I'm like, okay, like, we're in that line. We're in the flow of humanity, and violence is part of this, and it's tragic and horrible and sad, but it's also pretty of low instance considering what it used to be historically. And look at all this beautiful art that we make. We do good things too. Just to put myself in a place of like, we're not all bad. And then when I would go see live music, I have that same experience, whether it's going to the symphony, which I love, or going to the Hollywood Bowl in which there's no bad seats and taking in live music, and you're with that whole community of people and everybody's in a state of kind of ecstasy or getting stoned or whatever, drinking and eat, drink and be merry. And I've experienced way more live music than I have any real right to. I've been gifted with people giving me free tickets to Coachella for decades. And like, I've just seen so since I was a teenager. And it's one of those things where I have had profound moments of, oh, the humanity, like this is something we do right. It's something we do so right. Listening to a symphony, you're like, how do we fucking do this? Architecture. There's so much that we've figured out how to do and that we've done. And I need to stay in that place. And now, and I also need to remember that I am responsible for making myself strong. So when I start freaking out online and I'm like, ah, fuck, we are entering into some really fucked up times. And I'm actually no idea how like this marble is going to roll. And really no one has any idea. And so now when I start feeling that anxiety, I just go do push-ups or sit-ups, or I will literally just be, when that feeling arises, and this is just such the gift of sobriety, is that I can feel myself feeling that way. And now I have the tools to be like, get offline and go exercise, literally exercise that energy, and also make yourself strong. Do what you can to be prepared. Make sure you have enough water. Make sure you know, whatever I can do to kind of put myself at ease, and go look at art. I'll go just open a book of art of Monet, of like from the Chicago. I just have to remind myself of, or go look outside at the orange tree, or nature is another thing that I have to remind myself. You know, I've had profound moments in Joshua Tree, just of how small and fleeting this all is. And it's easy to become so myopic, especially when you're online. It's easy to lose sight. And now everybody's isolated, and I spend so much time in our Fetacy.com community, which is truly like a community now. And we work out together and we write our goals. And I'm like, it's become almost like a self-help group, like support group, because I don't know what else to do. There's, and this is the beauty of 12 steps, truly. Like, what am I powerless over? Well, pretty much everything. Literally everything. I can be a voice in the online and try and be concerned for people. I can create a community where people can come and better themselves. But really, I can control my mood. I can control my diet, media, and actual diet, and my exercise. I can control my immediate environment, like very Jordan Peterson, clean your room. Mm-hmm. Like see to it that your own house is in order. Mm-hmm. And I can be of service, and that's about it. And that's it.
I'm just going to let that sit right there. That's perfect. That's a perfect thing to say at the end of this. And it's maybe the most useful thing that's ever been said on this podcast. I'm not kidding. And I will remember it for a long time, because this is what I get from you more than anything else. I get, first of all, I love your political irreverence, of course. But as I said at the very beginning, like, your ideas about politics begin with the self, and making ourselves happier, not more powerful, not stronger, not more resilient, but happier. And from that, I am totally convinced we will have a much better politics.
Yeah. I think that that's what's worrisome to me, is that spending all this time online, everybody's projecting their cognitive distortions into their online persona. And you, to circle completely back, how long has Bridget Fetacy been Bridget? How long have I been Bridget Fetacy? Yeah. I'm very much, she was born, you know, we always joke Bridget Fetacy was born in the card aisle of a drugstore. That's like it is a one liner we use around here all the time. We're like, Bridget Fetacy was born in the card aisle of a drugstore. And there is some truth to that, but really, I think when I came on Twitter and took the name as my stage name for stand-up, she was born into the world. And I always say it was a total accident that happened. And I'm very grateful that the Bridget cleaning up shit in her backyard from her dog is a separate, separate because when I hear that now, like, oh, we have our guest Bridget Phetasy, it does trigger a bit of like armor, you know, like be protective because you're
public.
Facing. Mm-hmm. And I remember Louis C.K. saying he had wished he had done something similar because I can still be Bridget who's cooking and, you know, crying and dancing and laughing, and that gets to be mine. And so I think she's been around for 6 years, but I'll kill her at any moment.
Well, you are pretty mean.
I'll kill her, and there is a DNR on my online persona. Do not resuscitate. Let her die.
You're vicious, but I like it. This has been fun, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Fun. We laughed. We cried a little bit.
Almost. You almost got me there.
I almost got you. Damn it. I lost my bet with my buddy. No, I'm just kidding. just kidding. Thanks for doing this. This has been
really good. Thank
you. All right, Bridget. Have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
Bye. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.